Hello, and welcome to Required Reading, the podcast that revisits the most impactful books from our childhood. I'm your host, Erin Bowles. I am a writer, actor, and comedian. You may know me from Welcome to Flatch on Fox. If you would like to support the podcast, please go to buymeacoffee.com/requiredreading. Our guest today is John Paul Sarny, part of Greg Silverman's Stampede Ventures, where he serves as Executive Vice President, Head of International Content and IP Acquisitions. He curates and maintains a development slate, which includes a first-look deal with CBS Studios International Division, a joint venture with Australia's Kojo Studios, and projects across more than 15 countries. He served as executive producer on the comedy series Gold Diggers for Australia's ABC-CBS Studios and The Darkness for Iceland's Simon CBS Studios from director Lars Hallström, premiering late 2024, based on the best-selling novel by Ragnar Jonsson. Hello!
Hi, how are you?
Good! I'm so glad we could do this. Our book today is Jurassic Park from 1990 by Michael Crichton. I had never read this book before, so it was a real treat. How much do you know about Michael Crichton?
I mean, I would say that I know a lot because I was in high school in the late 90s and or the mid 90s, I guess. So I started Michael Crichton. I guess the introduction to his work was Jurassic Park for me. And then I started to veer out and do other things. And then it's amazing because, as you probably know, there was a Michael Crichton book that just came out, even though he passed some years ago, that was finished by James Patterson, the book Eruption. You know, his legacy continues and they keep finding things of his, but he really does have that sort of mix of adventure and science, which is fascinating.
Yeah, he definitely is sort of like an entity unto himself. He's such a huge, I think, going through media of the 90s and aughts. Sort of like he's in this too. Like he did ER, which is one of my favorite shows of all time, which started, he went through medical school and then decided he hated it and wanted to be a writer and started to do that. So he writes his first novel in med school, quote, for furniture and groceries, which I've never heard of someone doing writing as the money side, but he writes under a pen name for a while. He doesn't want sort of any of his patients to think he's like mining them for stories or that they could end up in his books. And he finishes, but never gets his license to practice. And that's in 69 and has written, I think, like 26 novels by the time I think he passed in 08. And what was wild to me about Jurassic Park specifically, he and Spielberg, because the movie obviously is got to be a huge part of the story. Iconic, and I would love to hear your story with the movie as well. What year was that? Do we know? We can find this out. 1993. 3 years later. But he has a deal with Spielberg before the book is even published, which you work in IP acquisition. I would love to talk about sort of that process and like what you look for in a great book. And this I had to just mention because as a writer and I worked very, very briefly in development, which they call it hell for a reason. The ER pilot is written in 74. The show does not premiere for 20 years until 1994. So good on him for sticking with it. And one last detail, 1992, he was ranked among People Magazine's 50 most beautiful people. Good for him. So one last thing on the year. It comes out in 1990. The Cold War is ending. Germany is reunified. The Gulf War starts. The Exxon Valdez trial is happening. Nelson Mandela is released after 27 years in prison. And on August 12th, about 3 months before the book comes out, Sue, the best preserved Tyrannosaurus Rex specimen ever found, is discovered near Faith, South Dakota. And then the book comes out in November. What a boon for him as a publisher.
It was a publicity stunt. Yeah.
Yes, for sure. So how did this book come into your life? What's your story with this book?
I mean, I think this is one of the first cases of, you know, I had loved always as a kid, you know, going to the movies. And if this movie came out in 1993, that sort of is on track with my sort of Goonies age of like when I was obsessed with going to the movies and also all things culture. And that, you know, that obsession has continued to this day. But I think that was the first time that I was like, oh, there's a movie coming out, but I want to be good and I want to read the book first. And so I remember getting the book. It was in soft cover. So, you know, it'd been out at least a year, I guess. And it was just one of those like ratty little soft covers you get like in the grocery store, like with a terrible spine that just like becomes like a U-shape by the end of it. And I loved reading. I was so fascinated. It was one of the first books that I couldn't stop turning the pages and flying through it. And I think that when it comes to commercial fiction, writers at the time, like Michael Crichton and also writers like Stephen King, like those were like the sort of summer books. Like I couldn't wait for, we'd now probably call them beach reads, I guess. But beach reads is maybe even a little bit more casual, but like proper adventures that take place in books. And he had such this amazing long and storied career. And then you mentioned the books that he was writing under a pseudonym. He wrote this book, A Case of Need, I think was probably the first book that he wrote, if not one of them. And that was very much about his time in medical school. And it was, if you had seen the TV series ER, which is a lot more soapy, but A Case of Need was, sort of a medical thriller. And that was another book of his that I read that was really well done. So I remember reading Jurassic Park in advance of the movie. And again, I had a terrible copy, but for the purposes of this conversation, I'm revisiting it. I ordered a copy, like a hardcover copy, which hilariously to me is, and this is maybe too inside industry, but like is published by Knopf, which, publishes, very fancy, fabulous writers. I just, it's a, I'm sure a huge boon for them at the time, but I just don't know that it's the kind of thing they would have in their wheelhouse now. What feels like a much more commercial kind of book, but yeah, there was Jurassic Park, and then he wrote the sequel, The Lost World, which I remember I did get it in hardcover the day that it came out, and I remember I read it on a family trip. We went to somewhere in Florida for to see my grandparents, as one does, and so it it maintains a very special place in my heart.
I love that. So sort of what do you think drew you to this? Like you said, the movie was coming out. Did you have, I think every, it's sort of a trope, kind of a generalization of like every kid has their fixation and dinosaurs is a big one. Did you have that at all? Or was it just, this is Crichton, so I'm going to pursue it?
I never cared that much about the dinosaurs, to be honest. It is, in this very Hollywood way, it's about the hook. It's a theme park with dinosaurs, but circa now. And how amazing of a premise. And it's so rare. We find there's things like this and Harry Potter and we his Dark Materials. There are things that are just super unique. And then for 20 years afterwards, we'll see a lot of books and movies and TV shows that are just derivative of those things. So it's really nice to see something that feels fresh and original and has a great hook to it, because that's what we all look for when we're watching, film and television and reading books, to be honest.
Yeah, it is. I think that's maybe one of the things that, to my mind, kind of defines Crichton is these incredible setups of, and that it is so so easy to pitch of like dinosaur amusement park, three words, and here we go. And I think that was something interesting in reading the book is that they really are selling it as a zoo, and that everyone loves zoos. Zoos are the biggest industry in the world, and I feel like that is maybe the only part that really does not hold up is. Zoos feel like they're failing and kind of morally questionable, but amusement parks are still absolutely huge. And I think the character of John Hammond, the billionaire who's financing the whole thing and kind of refuses to hear reason, I think is just gets more and more applicable as time goes on, I think.
Yeah, there's a few of those that we see, a little bit too much of, to be
Oh,
honest.
yeah. And it's sort of like it does make you a little bit thankful that they've just been doing rockets and leaving the planet rather than this. But I also wanted to talk about sort of, I think so much of it is about kind of nature and horror. And I know I found a lot of similarity. Those often sort of crossed in the Venn diagram. There was a lot of overlap in there. Did you read a lot of horror or thriller? You were sort of touching on that. Was that also, and you talked about Goonies and adventure?
Yeah, I did. I mean, I think that, I grew up in those Amblin kind of years, as we describe them, with, movies like E.T., that, there should be this kind of escapist quality, and it should be really fun, and it should be scary, but with a wink. I mean, still to this day, I think that Poltergeist is one of the scariest movies that I've ever seen, and it's rated PG because there's really nothing that objectionable about it. And then if you look at another, scary movie, like I remember the movie again with the books before the film. The movie The Exorcist. My parents would not let me watch the movie. They said, unless you read the book. And I said, great. So I read the book, terrified me. I watched the movie and I was like, is this a comedy? Her head is spinning around and she's just throwing up. And like it felt so far removed from the book itself. And when you're reading the book, because any book you read, you are a character in it, you know, because you are responding to everything that happens and you can't help but do that. And then so immediately you're putting all of your greatest fears or greatest ambitions on those characters and in that world. You are creating, if there's any gaps in the wallpaper that the writer hasn't filled out, you are filling them in for that person. So that's the amazing thing about reading and the experience of reading.
Did you, I mean, I think you were roughly high school, and Tim, Tim's not necessarily the protagonist, but he is kind of the audience insert. Did you see a lot of overlap with yourself in that, or was it maybe like Alan Grant or Ian Malcolm or sort of the larger than life kind of characters?
I was definitely more the Alan Grant. I think it was the, like, you know, I'm trying to work here and the helicopter's landing and making a dusty mess over my business. So just, you know, at the time I was, you know, even though it was, I was going into high school, it was, you know, a lot of the characters I saw on screen were sort of those crabby, cantankerous characters. I mean, one of my childhood programs was the Golden Girls, if that tells you anything about me. So, you know, B. Arthur, and it all makes sense now.
Yeah, absolutely. And those, I think the characters in here, I think especially Ian Malcolm is sort of the one that I think sticks out the most and kind of sticks in your mind the most. I think he sort of has an incredible morphined monologue throughout the end that I think throughout this, something that kept striking me was there. First off, let's back up a little bit. There are so many huge kind of ideas and theories and kind of moral quandaries that are played out in this book and explored. There's chaos theory is obviously a huge one. There's the scientific question of just because we can, should we, improving on nature. Do you remember how a lot of those ideas sort of landed on you as a young person, or maybe how they carried through with you?
Yeah, I mean, I remember around that same time was the first time that I went to Washington, D.C. on a school trip, and we went to the on the mall there or wherever it was, we went to the National Zoo. And I remember seeing, and I have still have these photos. There was a panda bear at the zoo in D.C., and it was so sad because it was a cement floor and there was water coming in from I don't know where, and the panda was sitting in the corner. And it was like, this is not right. This is not the way that things should be. And as you grow up and you get older, you think about, okay, well, how can, you know, what is the value, you know, of places like this? And I've also been lucky enough for work. I did a movie in South Africa, and we went to these like reserves, and the reserves were, the animals were in cages, but out in the wild. So they had huge sort of paddocks like in Jurassic Park, and they were animals that were wounded in the wild and they couldn't go back because they would just immediately be killed. And so it was about, you know, letting them have a nice life for whatever time they had. And so something like that, I kind of am like, oh, that I can understand. But, you know, you don't want to put animals in, you know, into cages just to have amusements. And then, but then you also come back to, you know, what's going on in the world now with climate change in these past handful of years. A lot of animals are very much endangered. Like you mentioned, the show that I just did, The Darkness, which is a show that we shot in Iceland, and they have these beautiful little, they're like small penguins, the puffins. And puffins are great, and they're around kind of Northern Europe, but they are endangered, and they're still actually on menus in some places in Iceland, as well as horses, as well as sharks. And, you know, we all know about like shark fin soup and, you know, in Asia and all these sorts of things. So, you know, I have been a vegetarian since, again, this same time period in my life, 12 to 14 years old, really. Those were my formative years in more ways than one.
I'm from just outside DC, so I've spent a lot of time in that zoo. And what's wild is there is a national aquarium in DC. Not a lot of people know that because they think the National Aquarium is in Baltimore. Baltimore has a gorgeous aquarium. The National Aquarium in DC is like in the basement of an office building with like one crocodile in like a fish tank. And it is the one of the most depressing places I've ever been to. And so that really put me off zoos at a very young, excuse me, a very young age. But I think something that really, and I wonder if you know about this or can maybe speak more to this because I looked into Michael Crichton, but certainly not like a definitive research. Michael Crichton was a little bit of a climate change denier near the end of his life. 2005 testifies in front of Congress, and obviously 2005, like we know so much more than we did then, and I think a lot of Michael Crichton's disagreements were about methodology, about, you know, we're not studying this in the right way, we're not looking at this in the right way. I think I made the mistake repeatedly of conflating Crichton's ideas with Malcolm's ideas and sort of seeing that as like a self-insert character. But I think global warming just gets a becomes like a bigger and bigger subject every year. I mean, the hurricanes in Florida are just nightmarish. And we both went to Savannah for college. I had at least two hurricanes when I went in my 4 years. But Malcolm, in that big speech, the line from the movie, and I don't know if it's in the book, is life finds a way. Like, even if we die, life will continue on this earth. And I think the thing that I kept like screaming in my head is like, but I care about the life right now. Like, it's gonna be bad first before it gets better. And like, life will go on, but like, my mom might die and I don't want my mom to die. And I think that, like, that I'm still sort of, I finished this a week or two ago, and that part is still sort of sticking in my craw. I wonder if that impacted you at all, if you think.
I mean, at the time, I maybe didn't think about it as much because I didn't know enough about it. I mean, I actually stopped. I became a vegetarian because I had an art teacher who started a group called SEED, which stood for Students to End Earth's Destruction. This was a
Heavy.
yeah, very heavy, and this was like in middle school actually. And but anyway, that was the beginning, and that was, you know, the beginning of thinking about, as a young person, you want to think about, you know, how do I live my life? What are the options? And so I grew up in a household that was like Boston Italian Catholic, like very very specific things. And you know, but at a certain point, you want to say like, but it should be like a buffet. You should be like, do you want to be Jewish or Buddhist, or like, what do you most, you know, associate with? And all those sorts of things. And I think that when it comes to, you know, what's going on the planet, you know, I think you have to live a little bit, you have to see enough of it. And I think that as people get older, you know, their views and their politics certainly change, but you know, there's always better ways to do it. I mean, I think that you see a lot of kids who are protesting, you know, oil and things like that, and they're throwing paint on like the Mona Lisa. And I was like, well, that's, you know, that's not, I don't know that that's the right path. I mean, that's just piss off a lot of people, because you and I went to art school, and people talk about like, there are, you know, the sad fact is there are going to be pieces of art, and there are going to be things that are on this planet, like the dinosaur fossils and things like that, that give us more insight into the history of the world and where we've been and where we're going than any one person could possibly do. And especially at, you know, at such an early stage in their lives. So I think it's important to, you know, stay open to it, but also recognize that, again, when I was in Iceland, I mean, we had that volcano kept going off. And I don't know if you know this, but when a volcano is about to go off, you have just sort of dozens and dozens of little earthquakes. And so I, you know, my flat was on the 8th floor of the building I was living in downtown Reykjavik. And so like 40 times in one night, there was an earthquake. And that's a kind of a scary thing, because then the volcano happens, and I had to keep going in and out, and you fly into the airport and you see the volcano actually erupting. And it's a weird thing to look out the window and see that. And, you know, for people who live there, like, oh, it just happens. But, you know, it's actually the earth, you know, shaking and opening up and, you know, needing that release. So it's a very interesting thing. And I think you need to have enough life experience to come to those decisions. And also, the world will change, you know, very quickly right in front of our eyes.
The older I get, the more interest I have in consequences of sort of every little thing. And I think in one of the first pages, they're talking about, there's sort of a little introduction talking about kind of the conceit of the book about genetic engineering. There's this like quote, furious haste to commercialize genetic engineering. And at one point, I think at the very end of that introduction, maybe they say there are no detached observers. Everybody has a stake. And I think that as a child, I don't even like, it's such a bulky idea and such of such weight that I don't know if you can even really latch onto it. I don't know if I can really latch onto it now. That sort of like individual accountability in order to work together is there's so much meat here.
Yeah, it's that thing of, you know, if a tree falls in the forest but no one's there to hear it, like, doesn't make a sound, right? So it's, I think that it all, you know, does have to, you know, reverberate in some way. And it is, and sometimes it can go the complete opposite direction. There can be so much back and forth that everything becomes an echo chamber. At the same time, I think it's important to be, you know, a witness to what's going on in the world. And that's why we live in an amazing time now, because with there are a lot of evils around social media, but also social media, you know, shows us very pointedly like what is happening in the world if you know where to look, and you're smart enough to weed out the things that are not true, that are in fact false information.
Yeah, I think for, like you said, for all of the evils of social media, it allows us, I think it in a strange way, if it's used in the right way, can really be a tool for empathy and to teach things. I think I keep having this issue. My boyfriend recently said, like, are things ever gonna stop happening? Like it just feels like this constant onslaught. And I think, in thinking about life has a way, time just keeps sort of spinning in the same circle. Like maybe all of these things have always been happening, but the difference now is that we can see and we can know and we can talk to these individuals. And maybe that's sort of the impetus to change. Maybe that's kind of the special thing that we need to take on and create something better.
Well, that's what's so interesting about the whole conversation around, climate change and trying to, be and trying to ring a bell for a generation. Because if you talk to your parents or your grandparents, at a certain point in their lives, there was a moment when they're like, the earth is ending. Like it's all gonna be, and it could have been the Vietnam War, it could have been, it could have been Operation Desert Storm, it could have been World War II. I mean, can you imagine living through World War I or World War II? Like the world was literally on fire, more so than it is now, even. And so, or at least to a broader swath of people. And so that's the interesting thing. It's like there's always these moments, but I think that now everything is just so loud because everyone has a microphone, us included. And so, you want to be able to talk about things, and the reach is huge. And so there, I think there's hopefully, not always, obviously, if you look at the American election right now, but hopefully there was a responsibility that comes with having that microphone and being able to have an audience and recognizing what's in front of you.
And I think it feels sort of obvious now that I think about it, but I think this is a book so much about responsibility, about, if we can, should we? But I think there's also this idea of improving on nature and improving on reality. Hammond says, we know how the dinosaurs were, let's make them as they were. That's sort of the product. And I think it's Wu, who's sort of the leading genetic engineer, says, like, well, we can make them easier to live with. We can make them more docile. We can sort of, use the science to create a more improved future. And the quote I have is nature manipulated to be more natural than the real thing. I think it's such an interesting moment in the history of technology and the history of science. Like the same year that this comes out, I think is like the year that the first web page or the first known web page is ever made.
I was there, I saw
You saw it? Okay. I believe it. I believe it. But like I, at the same time, like I think what's interesting is that I feel like genetic engineering necessarily hasn't exploded in this way. I think we've gotten, there have been like more pressing matters almost of like
Yeah, I think
transportation.
there was a sheep or a goat that was cloned at some point, but
Dolly,
yeah, Dolly. So
yes.
I mean, it does happen. But yeah, the question is, and then you have to wonder, what is the reasoning behind it? I mean, there are, some of these billionaires who talk about how, on the one hand, they're afraid of the population dropping across the planet, but then they also say, well, we have to go to Mars. I was like, well, why do we need to go to Mars? Like, shouldn't we worry about like what's happening here? Like, is Mars gonna actually save us? Are we gonna build some nice condos up there? Like, how is that gonna work? And so the question is, are we doing it because there's a real need and it satiates a need for the population, or are we doing it because we want to be, for something bigger than we are?
I think I hear going to Mars and I'm like, well, we could use that money to feed the people who are here and that'll help the population. But I think at the same time, like there's like a little child like instinct to wonder and to explore and to push that I like, even in the worst billionaires, I don't want to take that away from them,
Well, no, I mean, I think that's what has defined, so many of these, entrepreneurs and inventors, across time. And, we've seen great strides in science and technology, and I hope that we continue to see that. And a lot of them have come from, places like the United States, where there are resources to do that, or maybe we just have more people and it just seems like, there's, more coming out of the US. But those are great things, and we do, everyone should have that kind of that sense of wonder. But also, I think that just as you take a course in, math and science and astronomy, like they're also, you should be taking a class. Like in high school, we took classes on like world religion and ethics, things like that. Like you have to have them, roughly at the same time, because if you wait till you're in the third chapter of your life, you can't really take the ethics class. It's a bit late then.
That definitely, I was in school during the first like huge push for STEM. And as an art kid, it was like it was very alarming to be like, no, there's still like there's a lot of value. And it, like you said, it's that balance that you can't separate those two, because if you start to have all of these scientific abilities without those ethics, you get Jurassic Park, you get chaos and mayhem and science doing things that it shouldn't. I really, something that struck me so much is I really thought that the theory that dinosaurs had feathers was much more recent than it is in this book. They are fully on board with it, and I really thought that was like a 21st century discovery. I was duped, but I think something that I have to credit Crichton with in this book is that Crichton says, like, or at least presents a theory on like why do kids love dinosaurs? And it took my breath away. He says these gigantic creatures personified the uncontrollable force of looming authority. They were symbolic parents, fascinating and frightening like parents, and kids loved them as they loved their parents. Do you think you took that in at all as a kid? Do you think, or do you, what do you think sort of your relationship with like so much of childhood is about bumping up against authority and all the power that you don't have?
I mean, I never, equated that with, with this story and with dinosaurs and things like that. But yeah, I think that there always is the idea of authority and, how do we push up against that? How do we rebel in whatever way we choose to? But I think that it changes really for every generation and what people want to do. And it's, people who are, conscientious objectors to war and things like that, or it's more, things like science and climate change. Like, you never know. But with the dinosaurs, I don't think that was that's not how I saw them. I saw them as these kind of like scary but fascinating animals, and just how cool would it be as if you go on safari, to see animals in the wild, and that's the great and terrifying thing. And actually, the way that the book opens, which I had forgotten until I revisited it, was that it opens in this sort of like mysterious kind of way, that someone comes in and was like, oh, he was run over by like a tractor. Like, there's some weird excuse that why he has a slash across the front of his body. And then the nurse is like, no, that's not right. So, but there's that kind of like, and it goes back to the Spielberg of it all. There's this like Jaws effect. That's how you build suspense, and that's the amazing thing. And in the film of Jurassic Park, they did that so beautifully too. When they started to introduce the Velociraptors, there was that kind of cage they're all in. You just see like the bushes rattle, like shaking. But that's great. That's how you build suspense, and that's how you build terror, and that's what part of the adventure is. And that's climbing up on the roller coaster. So all of those things, I think, are really fun. And yeah, and so it wasn't so much about power and authority to me. It was just about like a great, sort of thrill ride.
When you read this book, what do you think the thing were the things that like really did scare you? I think as a kid, I had this big I when I was in sixth grade, I got lost in the woods, and that was like the big traumatizing thing. And then I watched Blair Witch Project for the first time when I was in college for a cinema studies class. And Blair Witch Project was shot about 45 minutes away from where I was from, so it was the same woods, and that was very, very traumatizing to watch that. But in that very scary thing, nothing was there, and it was the absence of that, and it was a twig snapping here and a rustle over here.
Well, just real, I'll tell you real quick my Blair Witch story, which is that I saw the Blair Witch Project. It was the weekend that it opened, and I saw it. I was studying at Emerson, I think, at the time, and it was playing in a cinema in Boston. And I went, and nobody knew what it was, and so everyone thought it was like, oh, this documentary. And it was the only place that it was playing across like three different states in New England.
Oh
And they
my
had a
gosh.
speech before the movie. They said, people have driven down from Maine. Please do not like spoil the movie. Don't write about it. I think that they were the early days of blogs, but maybe barely. And so they were very afraid of any kind of spoilers. But that became a sensation because people didn't quite know what it was. They didn't know what to make of it. And so, on the one hand, that's something that is really fun. But sorry, what was the question? I'll go back to the question.
I mean, was it a good question even? It's sort of about fear. You know what the sort of when you read this, I think like dinosaurs are so distant and so far out there. And I think finding why these books stay with us is sort of finding the things that feel applicable. And I think part of that is just nature, is how uncontrollable things are. What scared you?
Well, I think that it was the adventure part that he was so good at writing, because it was within the park. There's like, oh, like the car is going over the ravine, or you're going to get electrocuted on that fence. And a lot of that's really done well in the movie. And the thing between the movie and the book is that And Crichton has always done this really well. You know, he writes these short chapters. So he starts the roller coaster, then he jumps over here, and then he'll come back. And so I think that's the great way to build suspense. And that's how, you know, if you're reading, you know, something that's really fun, either it's whether it's a mystery or a thriller or horror, like that's how you do it. And you have to, you know, keep teasing people, and that's how you keep their attention, the like short Dickensian chapters.
Yeah, and I was so struck by sort of computers felt very new in reading it at least, but how he kind of like you get to see the computer screens. You get to kind of interact with it as Tim interacts with it, which I think must have been successful in the 90s. I mean, the book succeeded and obviously it was immediately a film. Yeah.
Well, I mean, if you also look at it, I mean, Crichton is so good about doing his research. And, you know, even throughout the book, there's a lot of, you know, visuals of, you know,
Yeah.
graphs and things like that and what the computer screen looked like. And if you've seen the movie, that was, you know, it's that green computer screen that we used to have back in the day. But yeah, and if you look at his other work, like if you look at something like Congo, you know, is very, you know, rooted in science as well. And then, you know, something like Sphere, yes, of course, but also that's a little bit more, you know, it's a little more heady, perhaps. But you know, this was the perfect marriage of all the things. Even the new one, Eruption, you know, has a lot of real science behind it. But it's interesting, but that feels like you know, more of like a movie that, you know, The Rock should be in or something. And maybe he
Yeah.
but it just depends, you know, who knows?
Yeah. I think with all of the big moments of spectacle, I think some things that struck me the most were the really small sort of moments of bureaucracy that kind of got under. You were talking about that very first scene where he comes in and there's a nurse, and the nurse is also has another patient who's about to go into labor, and the midwife like sees these little lizards, crawling around on the floor, and that's the dinosaurs are getting out, and that's we know as a reader that that's important. But she sort of, I think the line is something like she didn't want to be a bother. Like she didn't want to seem silly. So she didn't say anything about it. I think when the fossil goes to Columbia in New York, a woman says, "No, that looks like a dinosaur. Like my kid draws that." And I think her boss or superior says, like, "No, this girl's crazy." And last week she thought someone else was following her and this and that. And it's sort of like all of these little tiny ways that things get through the system. I think also in the end of that first chapter, they talk about before you get to know everything, they talk about, this whole situation is settled with like some really quiet, really boring lawsuits. And in all of that, the sort of the dinosaurs and amusement parks and, carrying around a severed leg and a tarp, none of that comes through. And it's easier to hide those things. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's just about, you know, building suspense. And I think that, you know, even films like, you know, even a film like Erin Brockovich, which is like the villain is the water,
Yeah.
right? So it's like, how do you start to build that up? But there are ways to do it. And I think that, again, if you can tap into these different things, you can tap into the science, but then also the craft of writing itself and do those different things. I mean, I think Dan Brown does it incredibly well with his books that, you know, look at the world of art, you know, from hundreds of years ago, but also looking to the future of technology. And there's a fusion between those two points. And he researches it so well, but he articulates it so well also. And in a real kind of adventure sort of way. And someone's always being chased, which you have to have. And you know, these are the tropes that we love and that we love coming back to.
I really love things set in amusement parks, and I think it's such a great setting to combine. It's full of contrast and juxtaposition, the horror next to all of the fun and the childlike wonder versus the engineering and the mechanics of it. And I love when those things get stuck. And I think there were some things that I bumped up against on in terms of like logic, and also because I'm a nitpicker, but it was also things of like security program only runs with main power. And I thought that's so silly, but also I kind of believe it. There's a part where like no one watches the park at night. And I'm like, actually, I think you go into this project with a degree of, or the characters with a degree of arrogance, and that lines up with the arrogance of thinking, what's gonna go wrong at night?
Right, it's all gonna be fine.
It's all gonna, yeah. Hammond and his group really truly believes things will not go wrong because they don't want them to go wrong. And like, where Is that a money thing? Where does that
That arrogance, I
mentality?
mean, that's, you know, if we're going back to movies, it's, you know, if you build it, they will come from Field of Dreams. You know, it is a bit of arrogance. It's trying to will something into existence that isn't necessarily there. And it also, you know, maybe ties in a little bit to faith. If you work hard and do all the right things, you'll be taken care of. The, you know, whatever you call this above us will take care of you. But that in its own way is either arrogance or laziness, maybe both.
You say that, and I hear you say, like, if you work hard enough and put enough effort in, which I think to me sounds like American dream, you know, and I think there is something distinctly, uniquely American about the idea of Jurassic Park. I was wondering sort of like how revisiting it, do you think anything has like changed in your mind? I think I'm getting a sense of like great, a piece of IP has all of the great elements to sort of make a movie. But sort of what has anything changed or have things increased, you know, your views?
I mean, it's always interesting to read Michael Crichton all these years later because I think when he wrote them, they were so of the moment with all the technology. And you can see it's like, oh, he put in the floppy disk and like this happened. And you're like, yep, got it. But I mean, that doesn't, so it definitely sits in a place historically, but it doesn't take away from the enjoyment of it. I think the characters are still great. I think that the questions that it raises are still really relevant. You know, it's something we have to think about constantly now because we live in a world that is, you know, it's hard to tell, like, you know, what is real and what isn't anymore. And so I think they're very important questions to think about. I wish, and again, I think the first movie does a really good job. The other movies are all over the place, but and they keep making them. They're still making them. So, you know, let's see what happens. But yeah, I think that they're good fun, and I think that hopefully it's kind of, you know, spoon feeding the audience a little bit, so that as kids watch them, as young people watch these movies and read these books, they will eventually start to get it. But you know, it also speaks volumes that, you know, when I tried to get a copy of this book, I ended up getting, this is like one of the first edition books, and it has like, but like I couldn't find a really great like soft cover edition because it means that it's not really in print. There's not a high demand for people to be reading this book now. So people will go back and watch the movie over and over again, but it's not one of these things that just keeps coming back. And there are certain authors, you know, also in that era was, you know, Anne Rice, you know, who wrote these great books that are, it's hard to sort of find them. But now, thankfully, you know, because I'm such a book nerd, I track down all these different things. And Christopher Rice is working with like one of these like independent publishers to do like a hand illustrated version of Interview with the Vampire.
Oh my
So it's one of
goodness.
these things that it's like, you know, you have to, it's like a Kickstarter that you can do different levels and you get different versions of the book, and some they can get very expensive. But I think that it's become like more of a bespoke thing for people who really want to celebrate that. So some of these great stories are being pushed in that direction because, you know, the general population isn't so interested. It's actually easier to get a soft cover book, or from, in my experience, of Jurassic Park in the UK than in the US.
Really?
Because I think they're, you know, and I think there's just more reading that happens in the UK than in the US, even though we publish more books here than anywhere else in the world.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. I found a PDF online for free. I did pirate, and I'll say that here, and I'll cut it out later. But I think I use a lot of like library apps. I couldn't find it on Hoopla. Libby had a crazy long wait. And I was surprised that I live in a very densely populated little free library area in LA, but I've never found any of Jurassic Park, and I found very few Michael Crichton books. I found Prey, which is on my shelf and I will read one day. With the prevalence of the movie, I didn't think it ever even occurred to me that the books would be kind of disappearing.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting thing. And sometimes, you know, the books are just so magical. I mean, like the Harry Potter books, they keep reissuing them over and over and over again, which is amazing. But yeah, I mean, sometimes they fall away. And you know, even, you know, you'll hear about like, oh, there's this great mystery series from, you know, the 50s or whatever. And it's really hard to find sometimes because there's just not that audience there. And also it is such a busy marketplace. I mean, I think there's, you know, something like 1400 books came out this week in the US,
Oh,
you know, which
God.
is, it's predominantly nonfiction. Behind that is fiction, but then you also have like self-help and YA and children's books and then self-published books. I mean, it's amazing that there's, you know, I would hate to run a bookshop because how do you decide what on the table?
Right. I was at one of these little free libraries the other day and they had a lot of like very old books and I was looking at them and they're all self-help books. And I sort of thought, isn't that
Right.
nice that like 100 years ago we were still doing the same thing of just how to make the mind work better and use it for your needs. I loved it.
Right. Well, some, I mean, like I like some of them, like the 4-day work week. Like that's a good one. Like, yeah, let's immediately.
Yes.
I love this book so much. And it was really a wonderful opportunity to revisit it because it is so fun. And it, you know, I think that everyone needs to find these books that bring them back into the world of reading. And some, because people can, you know, fall away from it for a little while. And some people go their whole lives without, you know, being readers, which I think is too bad because there's so many wonderful things. And I always tell people that if you fall into like a reading slump, you don't have to read, you know, Dostoevsky and Hanya Yanagihara. Like I love those. But if you need to like come back in, like go grab a John Grisham, go grab a Danielle Steele, bless you, whatever is available at the supermarket, you're going to be able to read that in an afternoon, and then you're back in the rhythm, you're back in the flow, and then it gets competitive because you're going on your Goodreads and you're checking the things off, and you have a challenge every year, and all those, which I've neglected, but all those sorts of things I think are great, and I think that anything that is, as we say, commercial fiction can help, you know, bring you back into that, and you know the series The Darkness is the first of a 4-book series. The hook about that is that like it, well, I won't spoil it, but it's a very clever hook when you get to the end of the first book, you know how things are going to work, and so you know that was great. That was a perfect thing to turn into like a television series because it just like it zips right through. And I think everyone should find those. And I think that's also good when you're reading to, you know, to alternate. It's a little bit of that, you know, maybe read a classic, then a contemporary, or, you know, read a nonfiction, then a fiction, you know, mix it up. And, you know, these are great escapes. And if, especially we can put our phones and screens down for a little while. You know, this like Jurassic Park, I mean, like, look at this conversation, like that comes out of, you know, one book. And yes, certainly we've seen the movie, but I think that the book is raises just as many, if not more, questions and conversations, but also is a real, you know, work of craftsmanship.
The great thing about books is, and this one versus the movie, is you get so much more time and more space to really explore those ideas that you can hear Malcolm's big speech and then say, I need to walk around with this idea for an hour and then come back to it. And it gives you so much like it. Yeah, books are great. I don't know. That's the moral of the podcast. But maybe when we talk about reading, we have this idea that it has to all be, like you said, Dostoevsky, and it doesn't. It's whatever floats your boat, whatever gets you
Read that
excited.
trashy fiction on the beach, whatever, no
Do
judgment. Just
it.
keep reading.
Yes.
Just keep, Nicole
Yeah.
Kidman will be in the movie later. Just keep reading. No spoilers.
She will be, and a good wig.
I know she'd be, I mean, bless her heart. She does like 18 movies a year now and TV shows. Like, I don't know how she does it. But those are great. And I think that there's a place for all of it. And that's, there's a great democracy to reading, you know, because of that. So
Yes,
bless.
exactly. Well, would you consider this book required reading?
Absolutely. I think it is required reading. I think it's for anyone who wants, you know, real adventure, and also to know the work of Michael Crichton, who sadly is no longer with us. Also, by the way, read any of Michael Crichton. I mean, he wrote some of these like kind of like hard-boiled thrillers that came out years later, which have these like very pulpy 1960s kind of covers, and those are great. And also, like, there's certain books of his that I haven't read, like The Great Train Robbery and things like that. I mean, these are kind of classic books. I think that a lot of us will see over time, you know, these different lists came out. Like the New York Times just did their list of like thus far in the 21st century, and the number one book was Demon Copperhead, so which is Barbara King's Lover, so which is great. But you know, sometimes books like this are not necessarily on that kind of list because that's more, you know, literary fiction. But you know, nonetheless, I think it's worth having a crack and, you know, try a little bit of everybody. And yes, you can be a completist and read like I've read all of this author's books, wonderful, but also like have a nip and like try everybody. I think it's really worth it, and it's also makes it you know, you learn something every time you read a book, and even if it's something you don't want to learn.
I love
I wish I
that.
didn't know that, but you know, it's fine.
I mean, when I told people I was doing this book, every single person said that book traumatized me as a kid because it was so bloody and so gory. And I kind of didn't get that until he was carrying around a severed leg and a tarp. And I loved that.
Yes, I never minded the blood and things like that. And if you, I mean, even if you read, you know, A Case of Need, it's or watch ER, by the way. Like when ER first came out, it was, you know, pretty gruesome. And I think that all the medical shows, they've only gotten worse. And I think they try to do it like they try to up the shock value like every new iteration of those shows. But yeah, that doesn't really bother me. It's I mean, the other horrors are much more real.
Yeah, I think the most affecting scene in this book was there's a moment where maybe it's a velociraptor wraps his tongue around the kids. That really got me. Well, is there anything you'd like to plug as we round out where people can find you if you want to be found? I mean, obviously watch The Darkness and Gold Diggers if you can.
Yeah, so The Gold Diggers is out now in Australia, New Zealand, and Canada. The Darkness is coming out in November across all of Northern Europe and a lot of Europe in for on Sky Showtime, and then hopefully soon elsewhere. But then but yeah, every week certainly check out Page and Screen with John Paul Sarney, which is my podcast where I talk to usually a novelist who has, you know, the whatever book we're talking about has some tether to the world of entertainment. And you know, it's been wonderful. It's been a great way for me to get through my reading and have had wonderful conversations. And then we have one actually coming up in the month of November with the author of The Darkness himself, Ragnar Jonasson.
Oh,
So
nice.
he talks about, you know, having watching his TV show turn or his book turn into a TV series, and being on set and watching all of that happen, and he can't wait to do it again. So it's great fun.
Fantastic. I really loved your episode about the Christopher Isherwood biography. I
Oh
really loved
yeah.
that one.
Yeah. I mean, that's that incredibly intense. And, you know, Christopher Isherwood, I mean, all everyone in that family just, you know, wrote a diary about everything that happened. So it was such an incredible amount of work that Catherine did. But yeah, I mean, these are great conversations, and I think that it's interesting to look back and see the connective tissue between film and television and theater all the way through, and then like it eventually dovetails back to different things. And you know, speaking of which, I just did an interview with Dan Jones, who wrote Henry V. So it's a new biography on Henry V, which, you know, was made famous 200 years after he died by the play by Shakespeare, but has been turned into a movie countless times, and lots of movie stars have played that role, and that's a fun one too. So yeah, lots of great people. It's called Page and Screen with John Paul Sarney.
Well, thank you so much. Thanks for coming on.
Absolutely, thank you for having me. This is a great show. I love it. So
Thank
you
you.
know, it's a great concept, and I can't wait to see more.
Thank you so much to John Paul. Check out Page and Screen, his podcast. It is fun and insightful and wonderful, and you learn a lot about the book world and what's coming down the pipeline. What's new in books these days? What is new in books these days? All right, I just got some interesting possible news. Please send me positive vibes. And I'll see you next time. What is next week? Oh, Rishi Mahesh is joining me to discuss Randy Pausch's The Last Lecture. We are talking about death. You can find me everywhere at Aaron R. Bowles. Oh, and you can support the podcast at Buy Me a Dog. buymeacoffee.com/required reading. Do that. You don't even need to follow me. Just give me money. Money, please. All right, I'll see you next time.